right, so last time we were in chapter 4, and we saw this important scene where Mordecai and Esther are kind of communicating back and forth, and he explains the situation, the extreme danger that the Jews are in because of Haman, and they have this discussion about kind of the risks associated with acting, and he tells her that, God may have placed you in this position exactly for this moment, and that deliverance will come for the Jews from somewhere, even if it doesn't come from her. And she agrees to go ahead with intervention with the king and asks that the Jews fast for her, and that she and her women are going to fast as well for 3 days in preparation. So we're at kind of a transition point in the book here where up to this point it's been Mordecai kind of leading the action, and from here on we're going to be Esther's going to be taking more of the center stage. And so before we kind of go into chapter 5, I wanted to make sure that we've kind of covered everything that we want to talk about kind of in chapters 1 through 4. And particularly, obviously on my mind lately has been kind of thinking about parenting with the parent classes, and I'm about to be a parent. And, it's challenging sometimes looking through the Bible for examples of good parents. There aren't that many really, obvious examples to learn from. And kind of here in the book of Esther, and particularly in chapters 2 through 4, we have a good example of a good parent in Mordecai. And I thought it would be useful to just take a minute to think about what we can learn from what we've studied about Mordecai, about how to be a good parent. And I think when we touched on this briefly a couple of classes ago, and the thing I'd mentioned then was that Esther's situation in chapter 2, when she was in this harem and kind of sequestered with the women away from where Mordecai was, reminded me kind of a parent whose kid has gone off to college, and they're no longer kind of in this direct day-to-day contact with them, and it can be a challenge. And the analog to kind of this environment she was in with all these women competing for this prize reminded me, it's not a healthy environment to be in. And in many ways, at least in my experience, college could be a challenging environment to be in as well. And so just thinking as parents of how do you deal with that situation, I think we could learn from Mordecai's example that he was daily going to kind of keep touch with what was going on. And I don't necessarily think this is kind of prying into her private life. He was concerned about her and what was going on with her there, and wanted to kind of keep informed about the situation, as part of the, caring for her. And I think we can kind of learn from that example that, even when your kids, are gone, and maybe especially when they're gone and they're in these dangerous situations, if they're sending you a text message every 3 weeks saying, everything's great, send more money, that's probably not a full understanding of the situation. And so that I thought that was an interesting thing we could learn there. So does anyone else have things that we can learn as parents from Mordecai in the book so far? Yes. Right, and I think we can probably learn a couple of things from that example. One is that he was willing to kind of use his experience and wisdom to try to give advice and instruction to her, even after she was, you know, at least old enough to be, you know, gone and in this position. And so, you know, that's something that we can do as parents, to try to give, you know, not only, you know, teach them the Bible, but, you know, often we'll have knowledge from the experiences we've gone through that maybe they just aren't aware of, you know, some of the dangers that we can kind of try to guide them, you know, in order to resist that. And so that's an example there. I also think just from the way that Esther obeys Mordecai, you know, she obviously trusts him and trusts his wisdom and his knowledge there. And I think that's not something that just, you know, you can't turn that on when they're, you know, teenagers. It's something that's built up over years. And so even though we don't kind of know the details of how their relationship went when Esther was younger, I mean, it seems likely that this foundation for trust and obedience was built over time. And so I think that's a good example there too. Yes? Right, and that's, I mean, it's an example to us of how we kind of take care of our family in a broader context. And also just, I mean, the things that it lists there are things that, you know, as a parent or as a guardian, you know, these are, you know, teaching, et cetera, are things that we need to do. It's a responsibility there. So it's a good example there. I think another thing is, in chapter 4, he's asking Esther to do something, you know, going before the king and requesting, you know, asking for mercy. You know, this is a dangerous thing to ask of her. And it would be difficult as a parent, I think, to ask your child to go and do something that dangerous. But, you know, he's able to see the situation and realize that even though this is dangerous, there's a bigger danger awaiting, you know, not only her but all of the Jews, and you know, it's his interpretation that, you know, it's God's will for her to be here and to act in this case, and he's willing to kind of go to her and tell her kind of, this is what I think you should do, even though it's dangerous. And I think that could be a challenge as parents, that even if we kind of know intellectually that this is the right thing to do, the fact that it's going to put our child, you know, directly in harm's way could be, you know, there may be a temptation there to say, well, let's just try to find another way to deal with the situation. You just, I don't want to risk that, and Mordecai's willing to. And I also think I touched on this in my Wednesday night talk, I guess a couple of months ago, the fact that actions speak louder than words when you're a parent, and your kind of your example in your day-to-day life is going to be something that your kids really pick up on. And it's hard to find a, you know, Bible verse that says that exact thing, but I think Mordecai's example probably, you know, gets to that as well. Yes. Yeah. Right, and he clearly stated kind of his faith in God, and you can see that, you know, whether it was from that statement or from the way he's acted it out in his life, that Esther has kind of picked up on that and is acting on that as well. And I think, you know, his example of courage in chapter 3, when, you know, his willingness to stand up and not, you know, pay homage to Haman, even when it would have been kind of the expedient thing to do. You know, that type of example of faith and willingness to obey God is it had to be a powerful influence on her. And, you know, again, we don't know kind of what happened earlier, but I'm sure there were other cases where his example in his life, you know, taught Esther, you know, things about what she should do and gave her, you know, courage to do what she ends up doing in chapters 5 and 6. That's a good point. I mean, she probably faced temptations, you know, to let that kind of keep her from being well grounded. And it does seem like throughout the book that she is kind of well grounded and humble. And, you know, a lot of that probably is due to Mordecai's influence, I think. Yes. Right. He's honest with her, I guess, about the situation. He's not trying to kind of sugarcoat things and say, you know, it would be nice if you did this, but, you know, it'll work out. You know, I mean, he has faith that it's going to work out for the Jews, but he's still honest with her that, you know, you need to do this, and don't think that if you don't, that somehow it's all going to be okay in the end. So, I mean, it's important to be honest with our children, especially about the importance of kind of obeying God and, you know, keeping His commandments. It's not, you know, it's not like you can, you know, well, it'll be okay in the end. You know, it might not be. Anything else? Okay. Another thing I kind of touched on last time that I wanted to look at a little more is this idea of the way she requests that the other Jews fast for 3 days, kind of let me read how it's phrased. So it says, and starting in verse 15, "Then Esther sent this reply to Mordecai, 'Go gather together all the Jews who are in Susa and fast for me. Do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my maids will fast as you do. When this is done, I will go to the king, even though it is against the law, and if I perish, I perish.'" So she's asking them to fast for her. And, you know, if you think about, you know, is there any parallel in the New Testament for us? I think Paul's instruction in Ephesians chapter 6 actually strikes me as pretty comparable. So Ephesians chapter 6, starting in verse 18, says, "Praying always with all prayer and supplication in the Spirit, being watchful to this end with all perseverance and supplication for all the saints, and for me, that utterance may be given to me, that I may open my mouth boldly to make known the mystery of the gospel, for which I am an ambassador in chains, that in it I may speak boldly as I ought to speak." So it's a similar parallel here. I mean, it's prayer instead of fasting, but it's still asking for them to pray for him so that he'll have the courage to do, to kind of boldly speak what he should. And it's, you know, it's a similar parallel to Esther, where she's asking for them, you know, to fast for her so that she'll have the courage to do what she needs to do. So I thought that was an interesting parallel there. What do you make of the context here? I mean, this is right after the whole section with talking about the armor of God and kind of our struggle against the forces of darkness. So, I mean, what do you make of the fact that that's kind of included in this section? Right. You know, that's a good parallel to the situation in Esther, where I'm sure they were also tempted, the Jews there were tempted to be discouraged because of the situation they were in. And so, kind of asking in a similar way there. I also think, kind of with it. No, go ahead. Right. I think sometimes we don't really understand kind of that. It's hard to see that kind of in our day-to-day lives, that this warfare going on. And we may kind of underestimate the importance of prayer in that context, kind of as a powerful counter force or weapon that we have to deal with it. And, you know, in the context of the military kind of analogy throughout this section, it's, you know, if you think about someone who's going on a dangerous mission, you know, into the front lines, they're going to try to get whatever support they can from their comrades. And, you know, that would just be understood that, you know, if I can assist somehow, then that's what I should be doing. And it's a similar situation here that, you know, I think I said this last time, but it's easy to remember to pray for people when, you know, they're ill or, you know, there's something obviously physically wrong that you can pray for, but sometimes when we need our prayers the most is when we're going into a difficult, dangerous spiritual situation. And, you know, I think that's a good example of that. Anything else on that? Oh, yeah. Okay, sure. Best route to go, then I'm going to go. Right. I mean, he trusts her judgment in this case, and you know, and I think that's a good point. That you know, hopefully, there will come a point where it's not. I mean, I guess it's not always kind of a totally one-way flow, but I think as the child gets older, the hope would be that it would become more of a kind of back and forth, and that you would each be strengthening and learning and helping each other grow instead of kind of the. You know, obviously, I'm still at the very beginning of this journey, so I've seen it from the one side, but hopefully it'll work from the other side, too. Okay. Another thing that I wanted to look at briefly was the issue of the fasting. And one reason was because I hadn't read this verse last time, but I think it's an interesting look at kind of the purpose of fasting, or at least one of the purposes of fasting, and that's in Ezra chapter 8, verse 21. And here, Ezra is about to lead this group of people from, I guess they're at the river of Ahava. Not sure exactly where that is, but they're in Babylon, and they went with him to Babylon. I'm not sure exactly where they are right now, but they're about to go on this journey from here back to Jerusalem. And in verse 21, Ezra says, "Then I proclaimed a fast there at the river of Ahava, that we might humble ourselves before our God, to seek from him the right way for us and our little ones and all our possessions." And I think this is something I'd never really brought out when thinking about fasting, was the idea of humility, and that it's a way to kind of humble yourself before God. And you know, it makes sense. It's you know, you're trying to get rid of all of the distractions and things that can kind of take your focus away from God, and it's a way of saying, you know, okay, you are the most important thing, and I'm going to remove all of this other stuff that's not as important and give my focus solely to you. And it, at least for me, it helps me kind of understand kind of the purpose and the usefulness of something like fasting. And, you know, thinking about in the New Testament, there are a few mentions of fasting, but there's not a whole lot about fasting, you know, particularly compared to prayer, where we're many places we're commanded and instructed to pray, but there's not really a, you know, command that we fast. And so, you know, thinking about, you know, does fasting or can fasting play a role for us today? I think this idea of humbling ourselves before God and just getting rid of the things that distract us from God, you know, particularly in a context like this where you're talking about preparing for, you know, a very difficult struggle, and kind of appealing to God for strength and guidance, you know, it makes sense to not just kind of fit this appeal in between, you know, TV shows and, you know, instant messages and emails, but to kind of push all that stuff aside. And you know, at least for me, you know, those are the things that tend to distract my focus, you know, more than even eating. It's work and just everything else in my life, you know, emails and, you know, internet, TV. And so, you know, I think maybe for us, that's the thing that, you know, in a situation like this, to fast by getting rid of all those distractions and really focusing on God and letting him know that, you know, you're more important than all these things that can kind of eat away at my attention and my time. You know, and I know I could benefit from doing that, you know, on a regular basis, but especially in, you know, a situation like this. So, you know, I don't know if you have, you know, similar experiences or thoughts or, yeah.
I know that a lot of like religious neighbors, you might say, they from the beginning of March until Easter is the period of Lent when you give up something. That like I know that like one of my coworkers, he gives up anything with sugar in it from Ash Wednesday until Easter, because that's just like it's something that
Yeah, and you know, I think certainly as growing up in the church, we didn't really talk much about fasting. It wasn't something that came up. Now, I don't know if that's just my personal experience, but I don't know if that's a reaction to the fact that other, you know, groups make a big deal about it, so we're going to go the other way and never talk about it. But you know, I do think this idea of focusing on God and trying to remove the distractions that can take away from that is a useful one.
Yeah. I think we do need to consider fasting as something that the New Testament does talk about. In the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 6, Jesus says, when you fast, then he says, if you fast, but when you fast, and you see examples in Acts and the New Testament when people are making decisions, or in Acts 13, when they select the apostles to fall, set out.
Right, I mean, there's a couple of times in Acts where it's mentioned in the context of kind of the apostles and the elders fasting and praying before making a decision, like appointing someone or sending someone off. And I think it's mentioned in 1 Corinthians in the context of relations between husband and wife, that you can set that aside for a period for fasting and prayer. So, I mean, you're right, it is mentioned. And kind of how we would go about doing that, I don't know. I mean, I certainly think the idea is a useful one. And I mean, really, you know, for me, it would be much easier to give up food for a day than to give up all the other, you know, the internet, email, phone, etc. And that just, I know they did a study of like college freshmen a couple of years ago where they had them turn their phone and their computers off for 24 hours and keep a log, kind of a pen and paper log, which they were kind of baffled by that, but of kind of how they felt. And it was just a very traumatic experience for them to be, you know, so cut off from this wellspring of everything, you know, that was kind of important to them. And so I think if we get to feeling like that, and there are times when I start to feel like I'm just being sucked into this computer world, that, you know, I think cutting it off and remembering where our kind of a focus is would be a good idea. Yes?
Well, I think ultimately Christ is in the life of us. And we can find out one thing that pleasure, you know, chocolate, caffeine, you know, off the bat, it's a fraction of what. It's a few less thinking about that one thing. Even if it's just for
well, certainly any strategy you can use in your life to remind you to think about Jesus and to think about what he did for us, I think would be a useful thing to do. So, I mean, whatever, you know, everyone may have, you know, put a post-it note up on your bathroom mirror, you know, when you're shaving to say, you know, remember Jesus. You know, it's something like that to just keep it fresh in your mind. It's not a bad idea. Anything else? Okay. Bill Wilder loaned me his book on Esther that Charles Swindoll did, and it's been interesting reading that. And he makes an interesting parallel between Isaiah chapter 40, verse 31, and this gap between chapters 4 and 5 of Esther that I thought was a useful one. So in Isaiah chapter 40, verse 31, it says, "But those who wait on the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings like eagles. They shall run and not be weary. They shall walk and not faint." And the parallel he's making is this this period of 3 days is a period of waiting on the Lord, kind of going to the Lord and kind of focusing on him and drawing strength from that. And if you look at what happens in chapters 5 and 6, you can kind of see how this is playing out in Esther's life. I mean, it says they shall renew their strength. You know, she definitely shows a lot of strength and perseverance, you know, in what comes ahead. They will mount up with wings like eagles. You know, getting away from everything and focusing on God can definitely give you a different perspective on things and kind of put things in a different perspective. And, you know, I think that could have helped Esther to kind of see, you know, the situation she was in and kind of think about how to deal with it. And this idea of running and not being weary, walking and not fainting. I mean, we do see that she is patient and perseverant throughout. And, you know, one thing that we'll see and that I think is revealed is that, you know, it can be easier to kind of work up your courage for one big moment where I'm going to go before the king and I'm going to ask him to rescue my people and I can do this. But, you know, as we'll see, that's not what happens. It's not just a instant either yes or no and it's over. It's an ongoing thing, and that can actually be more challenging than just working up your courage for one moment. And so, you know, as it's talking about here, that, you know, those who wait upon the Lord, you know, will run and not be weary, walk and not faint. Having, you know, the perseverance to get through and to sustain, I think is something useful there. And it's a great point. And actually, if you go over to chapter 41 in verse 10, it kind of speaks to that. It says, "Fear not, for I am with you. Be not dismayed, for I am your God. I will strengthen you. Yes, I will help you. I will uphold you with my righteous right hand." And so, I mean, here it's talking about that temptation to fear and the fact that if we have faith in God, you know, we don't need to fear. We can be confident and know that He'll be there for us. And I do think that Esther is a great example of that, you know, that she puts her faith in God and goes and puts herself in a very dangerous situation. So. All right, well, let's get on to chapter 5. John, can I get you to read verses 1 through 8 of chapter 5, please? Yes, please. Quickly, what he may do as Esther has said. The Yes. Yes. All right. So immediately things aren't going exactly like you would have thought. You know, you've got this big buildup in chapter 4 up to, you know, Mordecai asking Esther to go before the king and you know, request mercy, and she says she will, and, you know, there's three days of fasting, preparation, and so we get to this big moment where she's going to go before the king and risk it all, and you don't get the resolution that you would have thought. In the first case, she, you know, there isn't kind of a climactic confrontation between the king and Esther. He, you know, touches her, lets her touch the scepter, doesn't have her killed, and asks her, basically, you know, what do you want? You know, I guess, you know, he knew that she must have had some kind of request for him, otherwise she wouldn't have risked her life to come there. And she doesn't do what you might have expected. She doesn't immediately say, you know, present the situation, reveal herself to be a Jew, and ask for mercy. Instead, she asks the king and Haman to come to a banquet, which is, you know, at first glance, it's like, what's going on here? You know, and then you get this repeat banquet. You know, immediately they go to this this next banquet, and, you know, this is a king who evidently likes banquets a lot. So, but he realizes, you know, and still she's got this petition, asks, you know, what is your petition? And she asks the king and Haman to come to a banquet the next day, and then she'll answer the king's question. So, very strange. Yes. Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, we don't really get a glimpse into her mind to know kind of what's driving her here. Yeah. That's a good point. Yeah. It's a great point, and she knows that he loves banquets, and so what better way to get him on your side? You know, a banquet and then another banquet, you know, how could he say no? So, yeah. Well, and even better, you know, make brownies ahead of time. You know, do you want a brownie and some milk, Dad? You know, so then, you know, then you ask for the $20. So I think that's, you know, it's great psychology. And we don't know how much, you know, they don't say how much of this is kind of God kind of giving her insight, and how much of it is just her being resourceful and kind of you know, understanding this king and coming up with ways to deal with the situation. But it certainly, you know, it does seem to be you know, a good plan. So. Yes? Yeah, and I mean, I think one thing that she may have asked for and gotten is patience here. And sometimes, you know, just because you have an opportunity doesn't mean you need to kind of rush in and just get everything that you would ever have to say out right away. You know, sometimes an opportunity is an opportunity to kind of lay the groundwork for an ongoing relationship and to build up to a point where you could then, you know, say something and be heard and listened to more than if you just kind of blurt out everything you have to say right away. So, I mean, I think that's kind of a good idea in general, but in this case, particularly. What about Haman here? I mean, there's no indication that she's ever met Haman or even knew who he was until Mordecai sent this information. And now, all of a sudden, she's aware that there's this adversary of her people that's trying to wipe them all out, who's second in command of the kingdom. I mean, and she's the one tasked to do something about it. And she's, you know, she may know nothing about the guy. I mean, it seems like she's very sequestered and removed from what's going on. And, you know, I think that may play into what she's doing, is that, you know, she not only has to deal with this decree that was made by the king, she also has to deal with the root problem, which is this person who's second in command of the kingdom who wants to wipe out all the Jews. And even if she somehow gets the king to, you know, reverse the decree somehow, there, you know, that's still not going to solve all of the problems. And I don't know that that's part of what's driving her wanting to have the banquet with Haman and then have a second one. But it certainly seems reasonable that she could be trying to figure out what to do about that issue as well. So, I don't know. All right. Well, we will do the rest of chapter 5 and start on chapter 6 next time.